Good evening, everyone, and welcome to tonight's special stream, which, as you already know, is all about Venezuela. We've got a very special guest who I'll be introducing shortly, and he'll be doing most of the talking tonight. He'll be guiding us through this and telling us exactly what's going on there. You might have known I've done a couple of streams about this where we've mentioned this and we've sort of thrown out some theories, but this guy's an expert, so we've got a lot to look forward to. We're going to run for about an hour of chat, then we'll answer super chats after that. So if people want to super chat and want to support the stream or ask questions, they can. Now, we're live tonight on Rumble, we're live tonight on Odyssey, we're live on DLive, and we're live on Entropy. And if you want to share the links, please do. I obviously can't share them on X because I'm banned, but anyone else can share them, and it is much appreciated if you do that. Because I think it's going to be a good, very informative show. And it is my last show on these channels before Christmas Day. So after this, you're not going to get anything more from me. I am doing a few final guest appearances, but they'll be few and far between. So this is going to be the last show on this channel. Now, as I said earlier, it's going to be about an hour or so of chat, give or take, and then we will do some super chats. If you want to support me, if you want to support my work, please consider giving a super chat. You can do that directly through Odyssey and Rumble. You can also do that through Entropy, and the links are in the chat pinned if you want to use the Entropy method. Everything is very gratefully received. And again, this is the last show before Christmas. Now, if you are watching on replay and you enjoy the show, you can also donate on replay via Rumble, Odyssey, and Entropy. So if you're one of the thousands of people that enjoys the show after it has gone live, you can still donate, you can still contribute. And as I always say, if everyone who watched these shows every week gave $3, just $3, they wouldn't miss anything, but it would make a great deal of difference to us. You can also donate via crypto, all the crypto links in the description below, and you can write to me at mark@thefallofwesternman.com. So let's get into this and let's get tonight going. Now, I'm joined tonight by a very special guest, Jose Nino, and he is a Venezuelan-born political analyst and freelance writer. He is very, very knowledgeable on this topic, and he has written for the UNTS Review, his own website, the Occidental Observer, and he is the deputy editor of Headline USA. He currently resides in the USA, and the articles he's written on this, particularly the one about Israel's involvement in this, or the Jewish hand in this, which is on the UNTS Review, is extremely interesting. I read that before the show, and I'm going to update the show links to this at the end to include all of his socials, including his website, his X account, and Headline USA. Now, it's really important we get a bead on this kind of stuff, because this could be another major conflict from a president that promised to be the president of peace. And not only could it be another major conflict, but it is along the same axis of conflicts that we have seen before. And it seems that Israel is more involved in this. You know, the obvious answer always seems when America attacks somewhere that it's about the oil. But often these things are a lot deeper. And that's why I've got this very special guest. Jose, thank you so much for being here with us tonight. It's a real pleasure to be able to host you. And before we get into the show, please do tell us a little bit about yourself. Give my audience an introduction to you and let us know a bit of background, because it's great to have you on here for the first time.
Oh, I appreciate the invitation, Mark, and it's a pleasure also as well to be on, because I've really enjoyed your show over the years. Well, I was born in Venezuela, but my family came to the States when I was close, like 8, 9 years old. And since then, I've always been a political animal of some sort. I've followed both U.S. politics and Venezuelan politics pretty avidly, though the former I was much more acquainted with just because of just living in the United States. But I always kept Venezuelan politics like on in the background as well, tuning in every now and then. And I've gone through a pretty significant ideological transformation, I'd say, over the last like 20 years of following politics, where I started off as more as like a normie libertarian conservative, but now I'm much more focused on nationalist identitarian projects that look at challenging Jewish influence, exposing it, and also advocating for Western civilization and European civilization altogether. And the Jewish angle is really interesting, because as someone that comes from a history background and through my university studies, I've started to also change my views on how I analyze certain geopolitical conflicts by noticing the hidden Hebraic hand, if you will, behind many of these type of conflicts, and especially with Venezuela, because before I used to have very milquetoast Republican views on it. Oh, this is about like socialism versus capitalism, blah, blah, blah. But as I've evolved, I've realized that this is really about the Judeo-American Imperium versus like the emerging BRICS axis, and also more of a broader scheme of making the world safe for Jewry, a Pax Judaica, Empire Judaica, if you will. And that's really how I've come to my views over the years with regards to geopolitics, domestic politics, and my overall worldview. And I think it's very important that we have this, because we have these type of perspectives and are able to synthesize like the ideas we've learned over the years of studying just like identitarianism and like the demographic displacement of the West. Because frankly, the prevailing narratives that you see, whether it's like a liberal or like neoconservative type of perspective, they don't really tell us much about why our societies are declining and why are the regimes that we live under carry out these wars that are not in the national interest. And they're also part of the problem as well. And I think it's very important that we have people that not only are hitting the books hard, but that are also looking at some of like the most taboo subjects and trying to synthesize that in our analysis.
Well, thank you. Now, looking at this, a lot of people voted, and we're going to start with the sort of normie take here, and we'll build. We'll have a bit of a slow build so we sort of cover all the bases. Mm. So if you were to speak to a normie Republican or one of the sort of MAGA fans, somebody within Trump's sphere, they might be quite upset about this, quite confused about this, because Trump obviously came in and there were certain things that he absolutely doubled down on. He doubled down on things like immigration control. He doubled down on making America great again, sort of the idea that there were going to be serious economic reform so America would become an economic powerhouse. But one of the things he really doubled down on is this idea that he was going to be the president that ended the wars. He was going to come in, bring an end to the war in the Ukraine. He was going to calm tensions in Gaza, and that he was going to steer America away from recent history. And the recent history of America is one of constant, unending wars and foreign interventions. Now, here we are going into 2026, and we've got this president of peace, and he's already bombed Yemen. He's bombed sites in Iran, and now he's got his sights set on Venezuela. And this seems quite interesting because he's not even been in for a year, but he is already or has already targeted three countries. Now, how do you think normal Americans perceive this? And what do you think is the primary sort of motivator? Because I think the next jump is people are going to say, well, this is all about the oil. And obviously, I think there's a lot more to it than this, but how do you think people in America perceive this, and how do you think Venezuelans sort of perceive what's going on considering his promises of peace?
Well, yes, there is a strong anti-war sentiment among the Trump coalition, because Donald Trump's coalition is not like other Republican coalitions, because he brought in a lot of low propensity, actually ancestral Democrat voters into his coalition. And those people are not down with this regime change nonsense and all of that. While there are still legacy boomer conservatives that haven't updated their political software and still think we're in the Cold War and view the Venezuela conflict as this socialism versus capitalism type of crisis. But those people are dwindling in influence. And I've also found that when you actually explain the facts about what's happening in Venezuela, it's not about drug trafficking like the way the Trump administration, because you look at the actual data, Venezuela has a minuscule drug production output. And as a transit state, it's not even a big player either. Like the cocaine that goes through Venezuela generally ends up more in Europe, if anything. And to stress the point even further, like, if you're going to use that as a rationale, you might as well start embarking on like regime change campaigns, like in Guatemala or Mexico and other countries that are more relevant as far as that.
Yeah, I just want to jump in slightly there. I'm a big sort of follower of real life crime, and I've said this on the stream before. I must have watched hundreds of hours of documentaries about drug trafficking and the drug trade in South America. And until I heard Trump say that Venezuela was this major exporter of cocaine, I'd never heard them mentioned. I'd always historically heard about Colombia. But by and large, if you watch documentaries on YouTube about the drug trade, it's literally all about Mexico, because Mexico and the Mexican cartels have more or less taken everything over. Some of them still rely on moving goods for Colombians, but most of the Mexican cartels now both produce and export their own material, to the point where if you're living in the Southern American states, pretty much 100% of your drugs either came through Mexico or were made in Mexico. This thing of Venezuela being like the major drug producer, I can't believe anyone's buying that.
Yes, it's a farce. And just to illustrate the point too, countries like Guatemala and Mexico, like for example, Guatemala has historically been one of the most pro-Zionist countries in Latin America. And I document this at Occidental Observer as one of the first to actually recognize the state of Israel in 1947-48. And it has very strong ties to world Jewry because of its large evangelical population that's actually already displaced the traditional Catholic majority there. And that whole place and a lot of Central America is a launch pad for the broader Empire Judaica, if you will. And with Mexico, a lot of Mexican cartels, if you actually do some thorough research, they have some very strange connections to Israeli intelligence and even ex-IDF members, where you hear of stories of these cartel shootouts in Mexico and then like two or three Israeli nationals like drop dead or something like that, or there's evidence of that going on. That's a really controversial topic, and it also helps that Mexico has a Jewish president in Claudia Sheinbaum, which it makes her a made woman, if you will, and that means Mexico is not going to get touched in this instance.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing, because you just triggered something in my mind. Trump seemed all for going after Mexico at one point until they got a Jewish president.
Yeah, also, I would add, too, that if you dig deeper into the cartel question, a lot of the U.S. political class and business class is really tied up in with the whole cartel business in Mexico. And that's one reason why they're never going to like take punitive action against Mexico. It's just so embedded in the economy and also broader Jewry as well. There's a ton of made men there. And if you actually go to war with that, you're going to end up, there's going to be a lot of collateral damage of the U.S. political class. And it could have like Epstein style type of also revelations come out in terms of like the labyrinth of business dealings that these people are involved with. It actually could be a regime ending thing if they were to fall through with that, which is why they're never going to do it. But going back to the question about underground sentiment, a lot of people in the U.S., when I talk about this with them, they're actually just scratching their heads most of the time because they don't really get what's going on here. And my feeling is that most Trump supporters, even the ones that are that you would think that would be really hawkish, that are still like stuck on like Cold War era tropes, they actually are not very enthusiastic about this. It's the only people that are really enthusiastic about this are the kind of the Miami, South Florida based Hispanic Republican set that's represented by Marco Rubio and other Cubans, which is honestly a kind of like Chapo's Goy op for organized Jewry. Because if you look at the history of the Cuban lobby, it's attached to the hip with the Zionist Israel First lobby. For example, the biggest architect of regime change projects in Latin America is a Cuban Jewish guy by the name of Otto Reich. And I've written about him on Occidental Observer. He's essentially like the founding father of a lot of Latin American think tanks in the U.S. that focus on regime change ops in Latin America. And he mentors people like Marco Rubio and all of them. And his whole goal is to try to make not only Latin America safe for American interests, but also for Jewish interests, most importantly. And that's like the only real segment that's advocating for this. And also you have like some of the the Israel lobby and Jewish interest groups, because Venezuela has taken a pretty hostile posture towards Israel when Hugo Chavez came into power in 98, because Hugo Chavez's main advisor was a guy named Norberto Cerasole. He was a Argentinian intellectual that dabbled in a lot of movements in the hard right and the hard left as well, who was quite anti-Semitic. He was actually a close friend of the Holocaust revisionist Robert Faurisson as well. And he influenced Chavez a lot in that he gave Chavez more of a geopolitical worldview that would be hostile to the U.S. and Israel. And as a result of that, you've seen Venezuela basically break all diplomatic ties with Israel since 2006. It's largely cut off its oil supplies to Israel, and it's actually forged very strong ties with Iran in terms of defense and economic cooperation, which has really gotten the Israel first, especially the Iran hawks, worried in the U.S. And you see now a lot of Israeli think tanks in the last decade always viewing Venezuela as part of like the so-called axis of resistance of like Hezbollah, Iran, Assad, Syria, not Syria anymore, and Yemen. They view them in the same type of category, Venezuela in the same category, and that's one reason they really are trying to go after it. And it is true that people fixate on the oil, but it is interconnected though, because in a situation where you have like intense security competition in the Middle East, and say in a hypothetical situation where Iran is compelled to shut off the Straits of Hormuz, the U.S. and Israel are going to have to need like another oil source, and that's going to probably have to be Venezuela, and that's why there is interest in it. But it's true that the left like fixates on the oil, but they're not able to like link it to like the broader problem of world Jewry, because world Jewry needs that, because of the fact that the U.S. is really overextended right now as well with all of its conflicts in Russia, Ukraine, Middle East, and increasingly now against China, that they're going to have to go back to basics and get resources, because the U.S. military industrial complex itself is being put under a lot of the same strain that the U.S.'s broader industrial sector has gone through since the end of the Cold War.
You see, that's all quite fascinating. And we'll start by sort of knocking things out as if we were sort of, you know, doing a bit of a criminal investigation. So we'll start with the easy one, which is the drugs. Now, Trump has obviously, and I don't know a better way of talking about this other than to say it like this, ordered hits on boats, which we have no proof they were being used for drug distribution. There's no proof whatsoever. So to me, these are illegal strikes. They're assassinations. And I was saying this on another show this week that I was obviously brought up in the West. So were you. You must have sort of seen this when you were a kid, that we were always told that the difference between the good guys and the bad guys was the bad guys shot first, whereas the good guys followed a due process and then tried to initiate justice rather than some kind of vengeance or killing. So, you know, when you're brought up in the West, that's what you're told. You know, we capture people, we interrogate them, we find out the truth. If they're guilty, they're charged, and then we follow a due process through the courts. Now, Trump is acting here completely contrary to those Western values. He's basically just saying, look, we push the button, we fire the missile, we blow up the boat. And obviously, this is very convenient because it leaves very little evidence of anything. No one goes on trial. It pleases some of his more hawkish support base. But to normal people, or to people with a functioning brain, I think this looks very bad. And this looks as if he's using this as a prerequisite for some kind of war. And he's using terms like narco-terrorism. And obviously, you and I both know whenever the word terrorism is tacked on to something today, it's like the word extremism. It's used as a prerequisite for either a war, a shutdown, a banning, a raid. But these words are thrown around liberally. Now, I don't see, and I've dug into this, any real evidence that Venezuela is involved in narco-terrorism. But you're the expert on this. So what's your feelings?
Yes, this narco-terrorism type of label is the culmination of policies that the U.S. has waged with the war on drugs and the so-called war on terror as well, that have just amalgamated to justify another conflict, this time with Venezuela. But you really are seeing a repeat of the war on terror with targeted strikes, extrajudicial action, and the use of covert operations and special forces here in Venezuela. And the evidence, in my view, is pretty weak for obvious reasons that there's no transparency here about whether these people are actually engaging in like drug trafficking or narco-terrorism, which I think is a ridiculous term, very loaded term. But even if they were engaging in drug trafficking, I would argue that it's largely as a consequence to the really broad sanctions and financial deplatforming policies that the United States has carried out against Venezuela, which has compelled it to go on the black market to deal in drugs or evade sanctions, and tapping into like networks that Iran has, Russia has, or China has to actually make money, because it's being pretty much starved out of its resources. And with a blockade now that it's facing, it's probably going to go towards more illicit activity. But it's illicit activity that doesn't really affect the United States. It's mostly just to stay afloat and interact more with Europe, because Venezuela tends to have much more friendly trade relations with Europe in general compared to the United States now. This is the same thing with Cuba, because it's also connected too, because as I mentioned before, the Cuban lobby, they see this as killing two birds with one stone. But if they take out Venezuela, they could easily take out Cuba, because Cuba's economy is very interlinked to Venezuela and energy matters, and has also been under blockade as well. So Venezuela is getting the Cuba treatment right now. But I believe that this is a harbinger of very much war on terror actions in Latin America, not just Venezuela, where if they don't do outright invasions, they're going to start using more special forces and hidden hand, if you will, like the use of, for example, if you look at Venezuela's neighbor in Colombia, right now they actually have a government that for the first time is actually openly hostile to the U.S. and Israel, but that might change next year when they have a potential rightoid president get elected there. And they could use, Colombia has historically been the United States' most reliable security partner in South America. And it's also been very connected to Israel as well, in terms of the military aid it gets and the advisors that come in to train paramilitary forces. So if you see where I'm going this here, it could easily see next year, if the political winds blow in Washington's direction, they could have a very friendly government in Colombia where they could train a lot of special forces, paramilitary units, or even U.S. units, or even like IDF people in there to serve as proxies to travel across Venezuela's porous border with Colombia and cause mayhem there and do targeted assassinations and stuff. You've already seen this with Iran when they took out their general Qasem Soleimani, and also with the latest flare-up in last summer where they used all these type of decapitation strikes against high value targets. I think that is coming in the long term in Venezuela. If they don't do an invasion, you will see these type of assassination attempts from paramilitary actors and other CIA Mossad trained assets there to just mess with Venezuela. Because if you, as I've written one of my articles, an invasion of Venezuela will require like a force presence of like over like 100,000 to 200,000 U.S. troops, and they only have like 20,000 or so amassed in the Caribbean right now, close to Venezuela. And that's just going to turn into a total boondoggle, because Venezuela's military doctrine is mostly of asymmetric warfare. The assumption is that the conventional forces there will just disintegrate upon impact against the U.S., but they're prepared to launch a very protracted guerrilla war. And there's a ton of leftist guerrillas and other criminal actors in Venezuela that are just willing to stick it to any gringo U.S. invaders and mire them down in a conflict. So one thing that's why I think the U.S. will turn to more the GWAT tactics, because that's been the main focus of U.S. foreign policy now, especially in areas that are more like the world's backwaters, whether it's Africa, the Middle East, or Afghanistan, where they start to heavily rely on special forces. There's a good book called The Fort Bragg Cartel by Seth Harp that details this, because of how overstretched the U.S. is and how much strain the military-industrial complex has been put under, that it's going to these more sleeker units or just straight-up hiring sellswords and mercenaries to do their dirty work and fulfill U.S. geopolitical objectives. That's what I think is in store, because the problem is, as you mentioned, this is a very unpopular conflict that, frankly, is not going to go like the way, like, say, Grenada in the 1980s or Panama went, because those are much smaller countries. And in the case of Panama, there was already massive amounts of U.S. assets and logistical infrastructure in place there that made an invasion like that very easy, because it's like a de facto U.S. colony in many respects. So Venezuela is going to be a tough nut to crack, but they will try to use subversion, because there's plenty of countries in Latin America and also plenty of hired muscle that is willing to wreak havoc through irregular means.
Thank you. That was a very illuminating answer. The next point that I've got to say is, so Trump has gone for the, we must stop narco-terrorism. And some of his base have seemed a little bit enthusiastic about that. I had some pushback on Gab, actually, from a couple of MAGA fans who were upset that I was suggesting Trump was doing this for the wrong reasons. But I've had more people say, when I talk about this, the majority of people say, well, look, Mark, it's about the oil. And that seems sort of the common take. So obviously, when the US attacked Iraq, you know, people said, it's about the oil. It's about, you know, a resource grab. When the US attacked Afghanistan, one of the things people repeatedly said was it was about rare earth elements. It was about certain minerals that were available there. It was about the US basically strip mining resources from another country. So obviously, when you look at Venezuela and you look at its reserves, Venezuela is sitting on the largest oil reserves in the whole world. And that's pretty impressive. I think you're talking about 300 billion barrels of oil. So really, you know, Venezuela should be in the same sort of position economically were it not for U.S. Trade embargoes as Saudi Arabia. So, you know, countries like Saudi Arabia are oil rich. You know, the leaders of their country live extremely well, these sort of Saudi princes. But Venezuela is relatively impoverished. They suffer these sanctions. So the big takeaway from the normies so far is that this is about the oil. So how much of this is about the oil? How much of this is Trump's desire for a huge grab of all this oil, which is relatively close, would be very, very easily available if he put a puppet government in charge, and this could actually help the American economy? You know, is this just American greed?
Well, it's a combination of factors, because if the U.S. has a huge national debt issue, it needs a lot of resources to maintain its global primacy. And that's one thing that we're learning now, especially in the Russia-Ukraine war, that you need an industrial base to actually bankroll and just facilitate a peer-to-peer or near-peer-versus-peer type of conflict. That has not changed. Even with the fanciest tech gizmos, you can't do that. But I would stress as well, there's also geopolitical components too, where Venezuela is close to Russia and China. It's first off, it's Russia is biggest client for weaponry in the Western Hemisphere. And it's also a big economic hub for China. And this also is connected to oil, too, because the U.S. wants to deny China reliable oil supplies. And the best way to do that is by knocking off the government in Venezuela and installing a puppet regime. However, the Venezuelan regime isn't this super top-down communistic regime the way a lot of boomer cons or neoconservative types market as. It's actually quite a mixed economy, and it has been willing to play ball, especially with companies like American companies like Chevron to do oil business dealings and all that. The problem is that the big issue is that the Venezuelan government wants to have its share of the oil revenues. I mean, Venezuela's oil has been nationalized since the 1970s under Carlos Andres Perez, and that's where there's like a big sticking point with the U.S. And Venezuela's open for commerce with the United States on their like nationalistic terms, but they're not like super hostile to it. So, and Maduro himself is quite flexible on this issue, which kind of demonstrates, though, that there is a broader play where I've argued my unique perspective is that Venezuela is not only like a tune-up fight for a U.S. imperium that needs to find a W when it's taking a lot of L's or a lot of its victories seem very pyrrhic in nature, but also it's just another attempt to try to make the world safe for world Jewry, because in Latin America, it has become increasingly anti-Israel in the last three decades. And that's one reason why the U.S. and the world Jewish community went all out to get a puppet like Javier Milei elected in Argentina, and why they're propping up people like Bolsonaro in Brazil, and why they're going to prop up a bunch of rightoids in Colombia in the election cycle in 2026, because they are starting to realize that Latin America is falling out of their orbit. I mean, most of South America, for perspective, is already largely in the Chinese economic orbit. Since the war on terror, the U.S. has completely dropped the ball in Latin America. It no longer has that same hegemonic grasp it used to have during the Cold War against the Soviet Union. And then you compound the fact that since Venezuela was under Hugo Chavez, they were able to use a lot of the oil rents to not only build like a diplomatic architecture with so-called CARICOM and other in Bolivarian initiatives that would use the oil money to facilitate favorable trade deals with other Latin American countries like Cuba and even some Central American countries. But they've also used the oil revenue to build kind of like state media outlets like Telesur to propagate a lot of anti-US and anti-Israel propaganda. And that's why they want why the US wants that oil, not only just for like profit, but it's also resources that like the Venezuelan state would otherwise use to undermine Judeo-American hegemony in the Western Hemisphere. Also abroad too, because Venezuela under Hugo Chavez was seen as like a resistance state to the United States and had a lot of street cred in the Middle East and a lot of Europe and just the broader world, because it was seen as a country that was challenging the U.S. hegemony in a region where the U.S. has enjoyed primacy since 1898 after winning the Spanish-American War.
So the follow-on question from the one about oil is that very recently we've had a development on that front with China offering to purchase large sums of Venezuelan oil. And this is being done on an agreement where Chinese tankers will go and collect it, because there's no way the US are going to start blowing Chinese tankers out of the water. That would be the beginning of World War III. But it does seem, and I've said this with a couple of other international events, that America has threatened so many different countries now. Well, basically, I'll explain this as quickly as I can, because I don't want to do most of the talking tonight. But it's kind of like if you're the big, powerful bully in the playground and you decide to pick on one kid and you say to that one kid, you're going to go and sit in the corner of the playground and you can't play with us. Well, that's a power play. And you're going to upset that one kid and you're going to hold power. But if you send a second child to the corner of the playground and say, you can't play with us, well, all of a sudden, those two kids are going to play together. But once you've sent 10, 15, 20 other kids to the corner of the playground, all of a sudden the bully is then faced with a group of 20 kids.
A balancing coalition.
Together, and they're going to just get on with each other. And sort of America has sent sort of Iran to the corner of the playground, China, Russia, Venezuela, and they're sending so many countries into this kind of, you know, American imposed exile that the countries who are in exile are saying, well, there's so many of us that if we all just trade with each other, we don't need America. Yeah. And now you've got a situation where China are saying, look, we've done really well off cheap Russian oil because Russia are selling all their oil to China and India. Why don't we do even better with cheap Venezuelan oil? So what do you think the chances are of America being in a pretty sticky situation here with the likes of China and potentially other countries deciding to buy oil from Venezuela? And there is a limit to what America can do. So America can bully Venezuela. They can bully Iran. They can bully Syria. And they obviously played a role in the overthrow of the Syrian government. But bullying a country like China is impossible because they're a nuclear-armed country with one of the world's biggest armies. And America is overstretched at the moment, and the American military is in one of the worst states it's been in terms of morale, manpower, and the ability to put trained boots on the ground. I'm not saying they're not the best in terms of military spending and tech, but I think in terms of a ground war, they're not what they used to be. So how do you see this going forward with other countries reaching out to Venezuela and offering this kind of economic help? Do you think this will hamper the American ability to bully Venezuela further?
The dynamic you illustrated there is actually quite apt because a lot of schoolyard type of dynamics are very applicable to geopolitics. And when the U.S. throws its weight around, it actually creates the conditions for a balancing coalition of countries to emerge to actually check its hegemony, almost like a legion of doom, if you will, when you have countries like Russia, China, Iran, Belarus, Venezuela, North Korea, all pacting together in some shape or form. And that's one of the issues that the U.S. is facing now, where it no longer has total hegemony like it did during the so-called unipolar moment of the 1990s. And in many ways, the fears that a lot of these neoconservative and neoliberal interventionist hawks have in D.C. turn into self-fulfilling prophecies through all their actions and just myopic policy they have towards Venezuela and other countries, because Venezuela is the weakest link of that bunch because it has no nuclear arsenal. It's the smallest country. It's also close to the U.S., but it still opens up a potential Pandora's box because the U.S. is invoking the Monroe Doctrine. And when it comes to its hawkishness towards Venezuela, and here's the thing about the Monroe Doctrine, and this goes back to my point about updating your political software. That was applicable in the 19th century up until the 20th century when the United States had like a humble Republican lowercase r foreign policy where it treated it had like benign hegemony, if you will, in the Western Hemisphere, but it didn't interfere in Europe, didn't interfere in Africa, didn't interfere in Asia. There was a general agreement with the U.S. and European powers that it wouldn't be interfering in European affairs. In fact, at one point of that period, the British were actually helping the U.S. kind of enforce the Monroe Doctrine, but eventually the U.S. would surpass the U.K. But my point is, the whole Monroe Doctrine paradigm went out the window whenever the U.S. became Empire Judaica, whenever it treats the whole world like its sphere of influence. And that's no longer applicable. Like, I would take that appeal more seriously if the U.S. removed all its bases from Europe, all its bases from Africa, all its bases from East Asia, and it started moving its bases more like in the United States or certain countries in the Caribbean. Like, that's more applicable. And I actually, that's actually a sensible, realist foreign policy, but we're not there. and we're probably not going to be there for a while. But the thing here is that the U.S. is getting overstretched, and it's opening a Pandora's box, because if it's going to play this whole sphere of influence geopolitics game, what's to say that Russia won't do that as well, like, say, in the Baltic or the Black Sea, or even China with Taiwan, if they start seeing the U.S. Seizing Chinese vessels in Venezuela and starts doing blockades against Venezuela. What's to say the Chinese say, hey, let's do this with Taiwan to stick it to Uncle Sam, because that's our sphere of influence too. You can't have your cake and eat it too. And that's the problem with the U.S., that they're playing with fire, because with all these geopolitical shenanigans and really myopic decisions the U.S. is making by, like, assassinating leaders or engaging blatant acts of piracy on the high seas and engaging in blockades, those other powers are looking at them and they're like, say, hey, let's do that in our respective domains just to stick it to the U.S. And it's going to lead to a certain type of escalation on all fronts. And this is something that's not really being taken into consideration, but it highlights how the U.S. is in a dangerous game where it no longer has the same level of primacy that it had decades ago, but it has, like, the intentions of doing so. So it's going to create the scenario where a potential clash will happen, or the U.S. will have an embarrassing situation in the Asia Pacific or in Central Asia or Eastern Europe, where one of these so-called revisionist powers, like whether it's Russia or China, just says, fuck this, and then asserts its will and, like, challenge the U.S. to say, like, hey, what are you going to do about it?
That's interesting, and it sort of leaves you in a situation where, essentially, if the U.S. does assert itself in certain ways, it's very, very interesting what you've said about it potentially opening the doors to China saying, well, if the U.S. can do it, we can do the same with Taiwan. We can do it the same in the South China Sea. And obviously there have been issues with China building these artificial islands, air bases, etc., in the South China Sea, and militarizing its sea borders, much to the dislike of, you know, countries like Taiwan and Japan. But when the US does things like this, it can't really argue with China doing the same. So we've gone through the oil, we've gone through the issue of the narco-terrorism, and finally we get to the issue that probably most of my viewers want to hear about, which is the level of Israeli or Jewish influence behind these attacks on Venezuela. Because Venezuela has been a country that is outspoken, should we say, about Israel's role in the Middle East. It has offered some form of cooperation with countries like Iran, which are enemies of Israel quite openly. They've been exchanging missile strikes earlier this year. How much of this is down to Jewish power, in your opinion? You know, when you look at the sort of objectives of Jews around the world, both, you know, within the state of Israel and within organized Jewish groups, which act as sort of an international nation, if you will, how much of that power that they have, and it's sizable power because they largely control American foreign policy and large parts of American domestic policy, how much of that power is now being leveraged against Venezuela? And why would the Jews be, or why would Israel be so interested in this one particular South American country?
Well, I see Jewry, world Jewry, as, like, the only sovereign really in the U.S. and the so-called collective West, and they have, like, several Chavos Goy constituencies, like, say, for example, the Cuban lobby with regards to Latin American policy. But these are groups that interface routinely with world Jewry, are connected to it. And in the case of the Cuban lobby, there's significant amounts of these people that are also Jews, that they're either conversos or they're of, like, Sephardic or Ashkenazi extraction. Just look at, as I mentioned, Otto Reich. And for them, these interests intersect because there's no real WASP constituency in the U.S. that has the same type of power that it did, like, say, in the 19th or early 20th century. They've been pushed out. They've actually historically been the ones that have pushed back against the excesses of Israeli and Jewish influence in the United States. That's gone. And the thing is, with countries like Venezuela and others in Latin America that have a lot of resources, these come in handy for great power competition now that we're going back into a world where you're seeing conventional warfare come back into the fore. So you will need a large array of resources, and Venezuela and other countries can provide it. Also, I've said this before, you cannot, like, Zionism and this broader Jewish interests are not nationalist movements. This is a transnational criminal enterprise that also has imperial ambitions, and they want to have all their bases covered, whether it's in the Middle East, the Horn of Africa, or in even Latin America. They want to make the world safe for broader Jewry. And Venezuela, a state that has taken hostile diplomatic postures, has aligned itself with Iran and the broader Eurasian bloc that challenges the Judeo-American Imperium. It just makes it as an easy target. It is the weakest link, if you will, of this whole network, of the Eurasian network. So they're trying to look for an easy target to pick off, and Venezuela generally fits the bill for the time being.
So one thing I've heard as a critique of this is that Maduro is part Jewish, and he has said that he's part Jewish, and he has talked about having Jewish ancestry. I think it was one of his grandfathers that was in fact Jewish. So on one hand, people are saying he's highly critical of Jewish power and willing to do deals with the enemies of Israel. But then other people have said, well, counter that, he is actually Jewish, has Jewish heritage.
Well, you have to also keep in mind, in Latin America, a lot of political leaders or people with career aspirations, whether it's like in business or politics, they'll try to appeal to saying, like, oh, I have like a Sephardic great-great-grandfather or something like that, to try to move up the ranks and ingratiate themselves with world Jewry. I've known this anecdotally from people with Latin Americans in United States, especially those that want to move up the South Florida media ladder, which is heavily connected to world Jewry. For example, Haim Saban funds a lot of Spanish-speaking outlets in Florida and broader Latin America. And the thing is, this is more of a cynical ploy often used by a lot of like aspiring Latin American political and business actors to avoid being called like anti-Semitic or have like less pressure being put on them. It may be true that he does have like some trace Sephardic lineage of Maduro, because there's a good deal of Latin Americans, but he's definitely, when you look at the actions taken by world Jewry in the United States, they don't treat him as one of theirs. And he's not somebody that if you look at his actual concrete actions, tries to advance like the interests of world Jewry. And he's not like somebody whose political vision is shaped by a Jewish identity or trying to advance like the interest of like an organized Jewish community. Whereas if you look at the Venezuelan opposition, and especially some people like Maria Corina Machado, she's a Gentile, but she's routinely appealing to Likud and other Jewish networks in South Florida and Israel. And there's even some people as well, a woman by the name of Vanessa Neumann, who was a ambassador of Venezuela to the United Kingdom, that helped facilitate an attempted regime change in 2019. She's of Jewish extraction, of Ashkenazi Jewish extraction. So there's a good deal of people on the opposition side that are actually not only of Jewish extraction, but they routinely advance in Jewish interests, because she was one of the people that was really pushing the Hezbollah-Hamas connection that Venezuela has to justify regime change in 2019. I believe she splits time now between the UK and the United States, but those people are definitely doing it for Jewish interests. And I've yet to see much evidence that Maduro is working on the behalf of world Jewry. He may have Jewish extraction, but you have to keep in mind that a lot of Latin Americans like claim like being part Jewish and all this to signal like power or just to avoid certain scrutiny for being anti-Semitic, when in reality they may not even have much to begin with, or they might not even be Jewish at all.
And one final thing about this, in your excellent article that's on the UNS review, you also said there was major links between Israel and the opposition party. Now, when Maduro was re-elected, the opposition party actually claimed they had won, and there was quite a bit of wrangling over who had actually won the election, and it did result in riots and protests in Venezuela. I mean, very briefly, do you think Maduro did win the election? And how invested were Israel in ensuring that Maduro didn't win the election?
Yeah, the elections in Venezuela are always like rife with controversy, and I think it was like a very neck and neck affair. Like, the opposition claimed that they won like a super majority, like 70-30. I tend to think it was probably like a 52-48 split either way, because electorally speaking, Venezuela is polarized. In terms of how directly involved Israel was with that exact electoral process there, I'm not so sure that they're like directly involved in that aspect. They are more involved, in my opinion, with the media access. Like, the world Jewry is more involved with the media access and boosting that people like Maria Corina Machado, the main opposition figure in Venezuela, get. She, for example, to put things in perspective, in 2012, she ran for the presidency in the primary. She only got like 2-3% of the vote, but now, all of a sudden, after teaming up with Likud over the last decade or so, she now has been able to win the Nobel Peace Prize, and she's become like an international star. She was generally seen as an obscure kind of ornery figure that even though a lot of the opposition didn't like, but she pushed the envelope by going directly to the sovereign, by going straight to Likud and just the broader Jewish community in South Florida, to build up an international support base that really no other opposition figure has been able to attain in Latin America, because they've, in Venezuela at least, because Venezuela, they've had opposition figures to Chavez and Maduro, whether it's like Enrique Capriles Radonsky, who's actually a Jewish converso to Catholicism, and other people like Manuel Rosales, but those people never were able to really muster a lot of this type of international support, because they still played the Venezuelan game of appealing to Venezuelans and Venezuelan nationalism. Whereas Maria Corina Machado just said, like, screw this, I'm just going to go to the U.S., the NGO complex there, go to Israel with Likud, and then just also go to like South Florida to team up with a Cuban Jewish nexus there to get my money and also get a larger media platform. And that's why, like, people like her are really connected. Like, the Israel connection is definitely me on the media information war front. And I'd also suspect they may have some assets on the ground too that are probably ready to like pop shit off if things start coming to a head. But I don't know. I haven't seen much evidence that they're directly involved in the type of electioneering process for the opposition, but they're definitely on the information warfare and some of the black ops and like hidden hand operations, because that's really their like forte.
So there's a lot of things swirling around here. We've got the accusations of narco-terrorism, which we've widely debunked. There's the pressing issue of oil, which obviously can't be debunked, because 300 billion barrels of oil is a lot. You've also got this friendship or developing friendship between Russia and Venezuela. I don't know if you want to say anything about that, because you see, America are now desperate to stop Russia having more influence. Is this another axis with Russia?
Yes, but to a lesser extent, because Rusham, they have arms dealings with Venezuela, and it's mostly for defensive weaponry. It's nothing that's going to change the whole power balance in Latin America whatsoever in terms of offense capabilities. And there have been Wagner private military contractors that are based in Russia that have provided security to the regime and other regime officials, but it's nothing really massive. But I have told people that the Russia hawks have to watch out, because the more they intervene against Russia, like in Eastern Europe, you could see the Russians get really slick and stick it to Uncle Sambostein's and just poke Uncle Sambostein in the eye by providing even more aid to Russia or other forms of assistance to make things a bit more complicated for the United States and the Western Hemisphere. But they've definitely been largely eclipsed economically by China in terms of the involvement in Venezuela, because it's just like, the fact is we are moving not just like in a multipolar order, but more of a bipolar order, to be honest, that has China at the helm to challenge the U.S. But a lot of these countries are starting to definitely use Venezuela as a way to make the U.S. sweat. And even funny enough, one of the U.S.'s most reliable NATO allies and a willing collaborator of Israel, at least behind the scenes, Turkey, has actually helped Venezuela throughout its presidential crisis since 2019, and has bought gold from it and has given thrown diplomatic weight to it. And it's engaging in a lot of commerce with it as well, both air travel and economic activity. And it's emerged as a big investor that's helped prop up Venezuela. So even the U.S. can't control a lot of its supposed allies as well.
So saying all this, and building up the sort of picture we built up tonight, what do you think we're going to see in 2026? So we've said that, you know, we're discounting the narco-terrorism. We can't take the oil off the table because it is a pressing issue, and I'm sure Trump would love to get his hands on that for America. There is also the growing links between Venezuela and many countries that America don't see as allies or are actively engaged in some form of hostilities with. We said Russia, China, Iran, etc. Then there's this issue of Israel's animus towards the current regime. But you've also got China lending a hand. You've also got arms deals with Russia, and Russia potentially helping in some way. I'm not saying they will. I mean, they've been so stretched with Ukraine that they couldn't defend their assets in Syria, which saw the end of the Syrian regime. And I'm sure if the Ukrainian conflict hadn't been going on as long as it had, Assad would still be president of Syria right now. So I'm not sure if you could count on the Russians to be the allies you needed at the present time. But saying everything we've said tonight, and what you've said is fascinating and extremely illuminating, but what do you think will happen in 2026? Do you believe this will heat up? Do you believe Trump will continue tightening the screw? Or do you think Trump will ease this off and this will be something that America just cannot make good on, due to the fact they've been so overstretched, sending so much aid to Ukraine, assisting so much in the Middle East with Israel's crimes and constant conflicts? Where do you think this will go in 2026?
In my opinion, you're going to see probably like the Cubanification of U.S. policy towards Venezuela, where they're just going to have like an embargo on it. And you might see like the continued seizure of vessels, but they're probably going to drop really massive sanctions where Venezuela is effectively decoupled from the United States, and they're going to engage in economic warfare, because U.S. hard power isn't just boots on the ground or necessarily conventional kinetic action. They can use sanctions and other forms of financial deplatforming against hostile countries like Venezuela. That's definitely on the cards. I'd say it's almost guaranteed, to be honest. And then in terms of kinetic actions, and I think there's going to be invasion for one. The public is not – there's no real appetite for it. And two, I think it's going to turn to a mess. They're going to be have to deal with like a potential like insurgency. Even if they were able to topple the government in one clean strike, they're going to have to put up with a quagmire – of a massive quagmire, because Maria Corina Machado, for example, who they want to install as a puppet, her policies are straight up Reaganism, and that's going to be by default incredibly unpopular in Venezuela, because even the opposition, when you look at it ideologically, it's actually quite leftist economically, and there's no real constituency for neoliberal free market economics in Venezuela. So they're going to encounter a lot of resistance, and a lot of the Chavez supporters, Maduro supporters, these aren't people that are going to have like polite disagreements. They will actually fight to the death to like prevent that, because there's a ton of weaponry lying around that Hugo Chavez has distributed over the years. There's a ton of militias that are willing to actually fight back, and also a whole array of leftist guerrilla groups that have moved into Venezuela after the peace process was reached in Colombia, that are willing to attack U.S. troops, because they do. But leftist movements in Latin America are very hostile to U.S. invasions or any forms of like direct military occupations or actions by the U.S. against Latin American countries. So that's just a total quagmire in the making. I think it's more likely you're going to see paramilitary and black operations go on, because that's been the U.S.'s MO since the war on terror, especially after the Iraq war became very unpopular. You've seen the real massive expansion of the Special Operations Command and other hidden hand groups in Latin America, the Middle East, and Africa. And this allows for the U.S. to have like plausible deniability and the use of just irregular forces to achieve its geopolitical objectives, or at least throw a wrench in the plans of Venezuela and its other strategic partners in Latin America. And that's what I think is going to head towards, because we are in a moment of imperial overstretch for the U.S., but it's still going to remain dangerous, but in a very unconventional sense, because the U.S. has to recalibrate its strategy. But there will be countries potentially like Colombia, especially if they have right-wing governments, because they have historically been very loyal to the U.S. and have provided a lot of muscle for the U.S. to carry out the U.S.'s dirty deeds. And we have a sneak preview of it right now with, in Ukraine, a lot of the mercenaries being killed by the Russians, or actually Colombian mercenaries, because Colombia is a big country of over 50 million people that has a lot of idle military age labor that's willing to carry out the U.S.'s imperial objectives in one way or the other. And I could see them easily being redeployed for Venezuela, like in 2026 and beyond, if there's the favorable administration in Colombia.
So I've got one last question for you, and this is kind of like the wild card question, and it involves Trump. And you see, this is what I always find difficult when we're discussing current politics, because Trump isn't really like any other president. When you see other presidents, we'll take Bush for example, he had a very clear trajectory. You kind of knew what he was going to do at all times. Trump, however, he can change his trajectory on a weekly or even daily basis. So at one point, he's scolding Zelensky in his office and saying, you must end the war. The next minute, he's blown his top at Putin and is demanding more money get sent to Ukraine. 2 weeks later, he's telling Zelensky that if he doesn't accept his wonderfully written peace agreement that he personally helped write, Zelensky will be off the Christmas card list. And you just don't know what he's going to do next. You know, he falls out with these people, he makes friends with them again, then he falls out with them. And if you look at what's gone on with his relations with Russia and Ukraine, it's almost been like a roller coaster ride, and you never know what you're almost like a roller coaster ride in the dark. So it's up and down, but you literally don't know what you're going to get, because you know, you sat in the dark on this roller coaster and you think you know what you're going to get, and then boom, you know, all of a sudden your heart jumps into your mouth because it's hit another massive downward slope. And at one point, I thought the Ukraine war was going to be wrapped up very, very quickly after the humiliation of Zelensky. But it's still going on, and Trump is still flip-flopping between the two. And this puts you in this weird situation where Trump is the guy that tomorrow could say, look, I've had reassurances from Maduro. We're withdrawing our support. I want a Christmas with fewer conflicts in the world. And you'd be like, well, that's very Trump. And at the same point, you can imagine him walking out onto the White House steps tomorrow and saying, you know, I want troops in Venezuela on the ground by New Year's Day. I want Venezuela in US hands by New Year's Day. It can be anything with him. He really is like this wild card that in many ways is, well, I find him to be quite unpredictable. And sometimes that can be for the better, that he can say something completely amusing. You know, I mean, what are the sitting president mocks, you know, the death of some director that kind of wound him up a little bit. But then other times it can be for the worse. And he calls for sort of a cooling of tensions and then uses that as kind of a feint to bomb sites in the Middle East. You know, you don't know what you're going to get with him, good or bad, up or down. Trump is the wild card, but you're the guy who knows more about this than anyone else I've spoken to. Your articles are excellent. The wealth of information you sent me before this show and your knowledge on what's going on in South America, I've never seen so many illuminating articles. You really are an incredible writer. I've got to say to everyone in the chat, you know, do read this guy's stuff. It really is worth reading. But what do you think Trump's going to do? Do you have any, if you had to make a prediction now, where do you think Trump will go with this? Is he, because this is unpopular for him. Is he going to dig his heels in, or is this going to be the kind of thing where he finally relents like he did with the Epstein files?
Well, on foreign policy, I operate under the framework that it's ultimately the think tank networks, broader Jewry, and other actors like military industrial complex factions that ultimately determine and shape that policy, regardless of who's in office. And I look at what those people write about years in advance, as opposed to like what politicians like, say, Joe Biden or Donald Trump say, because there's some of this stuff is already baked into the cake, regardless of what Trump says on Truth Social or to the media. And there's a continuity of agenda. I think the Trump, the whole roller coaster dynamic you showed there is kind of like the good cop, bad cop dynamics the US will play in these certain conflict theaters to make it seem like it sounds reasonable, but it still pursues, when you look at the actual substance of policies, otherwise hawkish agenda. But it's actually more recalibrated now in a more multipolar world, because for every action that the US takes, it's going to get a reaction from its rivals. Might not be equal, but it will be a reaction, all right. And that's because we're in a different environment. And that's one of the main reasons why the US hasn't immediately invaded Venezuela and hasn't really taken the most brutal of kinetic action towards it, because there is a lot of people in DC that are having pause and realizing that this is not exactly a prudent course of action to take when we're already stretched thin against Russia, Ukraine, Middle East, and now also with the so-called pivot to Asia. And that's why I think you're going to see more of the same, of relying on some of the unconventional strategies of using special forces, black ops, economic warfare, as opposed to hard military power through mass invasions or much less occupations, because that stuff is costly and it will leave the U.S. not only very overstretched, but very vulnerable, where it can easily get outflanked abroad. And it could actually even create forms of diplomatic blowback where in Latin America, where they cultivated a lot of these satrapies and other vassal states there, where these states' political classes may start to realize, like, man, this country is a rogue country. We might need to exercise our options and diversify our portfolio, which has actually already been done to a large extent by much of Latin America with regards to China. And that's why there is heated debate in these circles and why there's actually not much concrete military action taken lately, because the U.S. is at a moment where it could face multiple Suez Canal type of scenarios where its great power status is diminished. That's why I think they're going to continue with a hidden hand, because and Black Ops, because it's they can maintain plausible deniability. They can use a proxy group and say that it's all organic resistance, blah, blah, blah. And it also kills two birds with one stone because it undermines geopolitical rivals and sometimes even can affect the regime change if the right political winds blow, like in the way of like Syria. But I don't foresee like a massive like invasion or big quagmire. There's people that want it, but there's also just the fact that the U.S. has a lot of imperial constraints that it has right now, and it's just not going to embark on these type of like Iraq and Afghanistan nation building schemes unless it just wants to torpedo its whole project, imperial project altogether. But I don't think that's really in the cards for the time being.
Thank you. That's a very comprehensive answer. And I think the American imperial project has never looked in greater jeopardy as it does at the moment. And I think it's in jeopardy, not only from within its own borders. There's always been opposition to what America does within America.
Yes.
But I think the organized opposition to America's imperial desires has never been greater outside America either. But more importantly, it's never been more organized. And I'm not saying that there's going to be some rising BRICS nations that will bring together an army and America will fall. But we are seeing countries break away. And for me, the most interesting example of this was when India, a country that usually has done pretty much what Europe and America have wanted, decided to buy Russian oil and swerved the sanctions on Russia, which was very, very interesting. And it showed that there was a route around, a viable route to major productive countries around American sanctions. So my guess with this, if I was to make a guess, I would say things will sour, but I think it will be largely driven by Trump's ego, because I think Trump has a problem backing away from things unless they really, really start getting to him. And you see, Trump has two things which are kind of like battle against each other. On one hand, he's got his ego and he doesn't like to back down. But on the other hand, he really does hate being unpopular and getting called out, because he loves everyone cheering him and treating him as a superhero. And you saw this with the Epstein thing. On one hand, he didn't want to back down because he didn't want to look weak. But when he realized his base were attacking him, that hurt his ego in a different way. And it's kind of interesting to see. I've described him before as a kind of Caligula-like character where you never quite know what you're going to get. At one minute, you're his friend. The next minute, you're hanging, you know, from your feet in the Colosseum being mauled by a lion. You just don't know what he's going to throw at you. And I think that leaves a lot of interesting options on the table for both escalation, but also de-escalation that you don't get with other presidents. Anyway, we've done an hour and 15 minutes already. It's flown by and I can't thank you enough. We don't actually have many super chats tonight, but if people would like to super chat, and obviously people have been very generous over the last week, I realize that I'm not shaking people down for cash. You know, if people have donated on other streams, I understand that they're not going to sort of, and nor would I expect anyone to sort of skint themselves to keep super chatting. But if people do want to ask a limited number of unpaid questions when we've gone through the paid super chats, I am more than happy to do that, because I don't want people to feel that like every one of my streams has to be kind of like a, you know, some sort of operation where if you don't pay, you don't get your questions asked. And I think this is a really important guest. You know, I'm not going to keep him here all night because I want to respect his time, and he's been wonderful so far. And I suggest everyone follows this guy and looks him up, because he does deserve your support. But we'll do the super chats first. If people want a super chat, they can. And otherwise, we do have some questions from you. And if people in the live chat want to throw out some good questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Obviously not all night, but, you know, for 10, 15 minutes. Anyway, here goes. Point gave $50 and just said donation. Well, thank you so much. It's very, very generous of you. A disembodied voice gave $5. Thank you so much. And said, Mark, I would like you to do a gaming discussion stream discussing retro game mods and discussing new events like the Concord flop. I personally would super chat significantly to this, as I'd love to pick your brains on video games. Well, look, I've got some streams that we can do between now and the new year. And in that time, if somebody wants me to do some like chilled out streams where we talk about movies, video games, the politics of the modern gaming industry and how modern games are being ruined by, you know, pink-haired tranny weirdos who can't write a good script, I'm happy to do that. So if people want me to do that, I could do that for you. And if you're willing to obviously super chat, that would make it even better. So you know me, I like to give something back. We do streams which people are interested in. I've promised I'd do things like that before, and I'm happy to. So yeah, I could do that for you. Iggs22 gave $5. Thank you so much. Said, Mark, do you ever see a scenario where the UN arms certain groups in Europe causing a civil war backed by the usual suspects? Obviously, they would blame this on Russia. How would you remedy this? Well, I'll ask that to Jose first. Do you ever see a situation where the UN would begin arming different factions, maybe in South America or even in Europe, and basically then blame that on Russia and lead to sort of potential, you know, US involvement or even massive clampdowns that would take away our freedoms?
You know, I actually think the UN is actually becoming increasingly irrelevant as a institution because of how, like, the US has become so locked in the hip with Israel, and it's just discredited itself in the UN, and it's such a sclerotic and inefficient institution when it comes to administering international law that countries like Russia and China, I've seen diplomatic functionaries actually talk about just withdrawing from it altogether because it's become useless. And honestly, where I do think what forces could drive some of those conflicts actually could be a combination of Israel and the pro-Zionist, pro-Jewish consortium of NGOs, where you're already seeing this to some extent with Morocco and Spain, where Israel is really connected to Morocco. That's an Abraham Accords nation that has sent in numerous amounts of both Arab and African refugees to the Canary Islands and even Spain, where they will do that. And there's plenty of NGOs too connected to Israel and just broader Jewry that will absolutely facilitate that or even fund groups in Europe because they really do have it out for Europe, these Israeli groups altogether. They hate them much more than even like the U.S., for example, and they see mass migration as and other forms of destabilization as a punishment for Europe's long history of dealing with the Jewish question. And I could definitely see that from those type of groups because one thing that we're entering more of Pax Judaica or organizations of the 20th century, these alphabet soup organizations like the UN and other institutions, they're becoming less relevant. And what you're seeing now is just more of like of the US going under like a Judeo accelerationist route where they act as the bodyguard for world Jewry. And you're going to see groups that are in that network more so than the so-called liberal globalist institutions of like the UN, WHO, and other stuff have more prominence, in my opinion.
Well, thank you. I do think there's always the chance for groups to be armed and for false flags to happen. I don't think there would be a way for the UN to arm people enough to bring about a civil war in Europe simply because the security services and the surveillance state are so powerful. I don't think you'd get to that. I don't think you'd get to that point. However, I do think it's within the... And I talked about this the other night on my stream where I asked if the Bondi Beach attack was a false flag. And I came to the conclusion it might have been, but more importantly, who did it benefit? And it obviously benefited Jewish power and the state of Israel. And I tend to put things in that legal framework of to whom the benefit. And once you found out who an event benefits, you can then start to establish motive from the basis of profit and benefit. That's literally how investigators and prosecutors build their case. And if we follow that route, we can see, who is potentially behind different occurrences. But in the idea of arming huge numbers of people across Europe, I don't think that would happen. Because there'd be too many moving parts, too many people involved, and I think it would almost be impossible to convince normal people, like, say, British people or Germans to sort of rise up against the state. We're just not in that position yet. However, there would be the chance to arm potentially ethnic minority groups, especially ones who have come here from war zones and have had military experience in those war zones. But I think if those things happen, they would happen on a much more localized level as part of false flag operations to achieve specific goals. So, for example, if tomorrow a young white man ran into a mosque and started shooting people, which I want to say on record, that would be terrible. I would absolutely disagree with that. I don't call for any form of violence. And we found out he was a young autistic loner that apparently had every nationalist book that was ever printed on his wall, but none of us had ever met him, ever spoken to him. And he was speaking to a shadowy group on Discord, which disappeared, seconds before the attack commenced. I would say straight away, well, has he been talking to feds? Has he been radicalized by, you know, is this part of a CIA op? Is this some sort of false flag so they can bring in some sweeping legislation that affects everybody's free speech? I think things like that, you know, do happen, but I can't see sort of a mass uprising of white people armed by the UN. I don't see that happening. We've got another super chat from J Dev Kumar, who gave $10 and gave the thumbs up. Well, thank you so much. It's always very kind when people donate. You don't need to ask a question. You know, donate if you see fit. We've got another question here, and this is an interesting one, which you might want to comment on, and I'm interested to hear this. To what extent is the economic collapse in Venezuela driven by US sanctions, or is some of this actually driven by poor economic policies? Because obviously Maduro and Chavez before him, you know, whether you want to call them extreme socialists or out and out communists, you know, communism as a system, you know, we know economically it doesn't work. Planned economies struggle. You know, they've obviously nationalized a lot of the industry, including the oil industry. How much of this is down to US sanctions, and how much of this is actually poor economic planning and Venezuela being a failed socialist state?
Venezuela's economic model before Chavez and Maduro, I mean, it's been structurally unstable since the 1980s. They really haven't been able to figure out because of how oil dependent it was. And I think that the big issue with Venezuela is that the ruling class there, whether it was during the Fourth Republic, like the democratic era from like the 1960s up until 1998, and even until the present, hasn't built a very solid industrial policy to diversify the country's revenue generating mechanisms and economy. And that's been a big issue. High oil prices during the global war on terror helped Hugo Chavez maneuver a lot. And once those prices came down, especially under Maduro, it's really hurt Venezuela. I do think they need to move more in the Chinese or like the Vietnamese kind of like Communist Party direction, where they have like a more pragmatic economic model that blends elements of state control, but also market forces. But Venezuela's economy is not as communistic as, say, like Cuba, for example, which is actually an even worse crisis in certain respects. But I do believe that Venezuela and Cuba's models are outdated. And even Chinese economic advisors that go to both countries have said that, and they have to kind of modernize with the times. But now I think the sanctions are adding a whole other element of instability that is starting to make the country very unlivable. And that's just adding insult to injury. And the ironic thing is, though, it may actually strengthen the regime as people start to associate the economic warfare the U.S. is subjecting Venezuela to with a foreign force. And that creates a rally around the flag effect. It is a combination of factors of that. And it's also, let's face it, Venezuela is a very racially diverse society, like all Latin American countries. So you're going to have a good deal of economic and social dysfunction baked into the cake, regardless of what type of system of government it has.
We've got another question here asking, how do other South American countries perceive the American actions in and around Venezuela, and which countries are supportive of Venezuela and which are antagonistic towards them?
So you have the most antagonistic country to Venezuela publicly and diplomatically is by far Argentina, because Javier Milei is a satrap of the Judeo-American Imperium. He's really a product of Argentine Jewry as well. So he's going to naturally be a total Sanhedrin slave to the United States and broader Jewry. But other countries, I think like Paraguay as well, have had choice words for the Venezuelan regime. Most countries in Latin America, they're generally frightened by the U.S.'s actions, especially behind closed doors, but they're not very big fans of Maduro, for example. Brazil and Colombia don't like U.S. overreach, but they have like nuanced positions where they will support the idea that Maduro needs to hold another set of elections or step down from power. But they have these type of positions. But there's generally in Latin American capitals and South America, there is a view that the U.S. is looking like a rogue actor. And it's also justifying previous administration's actions that they should be diversifying and looking towards China because it's viewed as more stable in comparison. There's really not many countries outside of Javier Milei in Argentina that are doing backflips and cartwheels over the U.S.'s campaign to put more pressure on Maduro. The most reliable allies Maduro has right now in Latin America are Nicaragua and Cuba, which are kind of like seen as like the so-called axis of resistance states there. But other countries, they're very silent or have expressed like fears of further escalation, but they're not going to go to bat. But long term, that could start changing if things get more kinetic or the U.S. starts just throwing its weight around in other countries, because U.S. has also been beefing with Colombia as well and other countries. So you're going to see that. I'd also mention Ecuador too. That's another really big U.S. puppet that also is taking a hostile stance, but it's definitely not a situation that's favorable for the U.S. in terms of building an international coalition that's willing to invade like Venezuela, because they're going to need a rightoid in office like in Brazil and Colombia for that to happen.
And finally, somebody's asked, what do or how do Latin Americans perceive Nick Fuentes?
I haven't really seen much like studies of how they perceive Fuentes, but I can go anecdotally. My dad, he's very much aligned with my views and knows about all these identitarian and JQ issues, and he generally likes Nick Fuentes. I'm not sure. I think that there's a lot of appeal in Latin America because of the fact that he will take some heterodox views on economics and challenge Jewish power, which appeals to a lot of constituencies there. But I think some of his more imperial talk is going to sour people. His overall views can be kind of fickle. Are actually kind of Latin, because in Latin America, radical movements, it's very common for people that are like fascists to be previously leftist or vice versa. And they kind of move in between that. And but I think that though his message is much more American coded and sometimes gets lost in translation in Latin America, I haven't really seen that many Fuentes lookalikes in Latin America. But you do see a lot of like MAGA types, MAGA grifters among Venezuelans and other expat groups that come to Miami in South Florida, which is the de facto capital of Latin America. That's more in my opinion, the Fuentes stuff, because the Trump movement, honestly, it is a glorified third world movement. I call it the vanguard of the so-called twerking class, because it just attracts a lot of grifters, a lot of influencers, and other people that are frankly just like low IQ. And it's perfect because it has broad appeal, not just like in Latin America, but sub-Saharan Africa and other regions of the world.
Well, thank you. Well, that's the end of the questions and the super chats. Thank you so much for answering them. Is there anything you'd like to say to bring this to a close before I shut things down?
Yes, I have one thing my analysis is big on is just looking at the facts, and I operate under the motto, be informed, not entertained, to always just read the fine print and question any type of narrative that's coming from the US, the UK, or other Western outlets that basically are engaging in disinformation and trying to warp people's minds about geopolitical conflicts or any other developments, and always look at the track record, because that's what I'm big on doing throughout my political career, of having worked in legislative operations and also doing a lot of writing and research, is just look at trends, look at politicians' actions, and don't fall for cheap rhetoric or the latest social media outrage.
Well, thank you so much. You've been an absolutely fantastic guest tonight. I hope we got lots of views on replay. At the height of this stream, we had about 260 people watching live. I'm sorry it wasn't more. I'm sure usually our Sunday night streams are a little better attended, but it is the last Sunday before Christmas, and I realise that a lot of people, you know, have plans at this time of the year and things seem to dip off. But you've been an amazing guest, and obviously if things develop, I'd love to have you on and maybe have you on for a full episode of Patriotic Weekly Review. I do urge everybody who watches this stream, whether you've watched it live or whether you're watching it on replay, to please go and support this good gentleman's socials. They will all be now updated in the description beneath the video. So that just leaves me to say thank you so much to Jose for coming on tonight. Thank you to everyone who donated so generously. And thank you so much to everyone who tuned in. I will be back now after Christmas. This will be my last stream. So Merry Christmas to everyone who tuned in. And I will be doing my next major PWR. There will be streams between now and Christmas, but the next major stream will be PWR, and that will be on New Year's Eve, and that will be a multi-guest stream, all with UK guests, including Laura Towler, Joe Marsh, James Goddard, hopefully Steve Laws and others. I've got to send out the invites. If they're free, they're welcome to come on, where we'll be discussing the highs and lows of 2025 and what we hope for next year. Anyway, thanks again to Jose, and thank you to everyone.
Thank you for having me on, Mark. It's a pleasure.
Honestly, it's been absolutely wonderful. Merry Christmas, everyone, and I will see you on the other side. Thank you all. Have a great evening, and I'll see you again soon. Love you, and good night.